Hello, everyone, and welcome to the very last episode of Season 2, the Talent Game Podcast. I'm your host, Joe Burridge, and with me today is Nick Button-Brown. Welcome to the podcast, Nick.
Thank you, Joe, for inviting me. And I feel kind of special to be the last of the first series, or is that just you ran out of people and you're slotting me in at the end? Yeah.
No,
I'm... if you don't answer that, Joe. Let's leave me with my delusions. That's okay.
Oh, curveball question. No, I've got a great number. I've got probably about four or five people now lined up for season three. I was listening to Up Down Up on Audible. This is a little plug, I guess. And you are the narrator for that. And so I thoroughly love that book. Gave it 5 stars across the board. I love that Kim was narrating in there, and there's loads of people in it. Anyway, I enjoyed the sound of your voice so much. I was like, well, you'd be great on a podcast. That is the connected dots there.
I do think Kim bait and switch me on that, because it is a great book, and I read it, and it's part of the interviews and so on, although none of my content got into the book, which maybe I shouldn't be worried about. But he said that he absolutely didn't want to narrate it himself. You know, he's Swedish, he's quite introverted, so I'm fine, I'll narrate it. And then we came back going, oh, can you do some interviews? He went, yeah, that's fine. So hang on, you said you didn't want to do it. That's okay. I mean, it's kind of nice. We get this format where we've got the book, and then we have some separate interviews, and we have kind of narrating as well. So it worked out quite nicely in the end. But I still feel that he tricked me.
Yeah. It's such a good point, because like Kim starts off the book by being like, "Hi, I'm Kim. I'm a mild mannered Swedish man, and I don't like narrating things." And then I'm like, "You actually got quite a bit of narration in there." So that's funny. But yeah, I thoroughly enjoyed it. And so that's why I was like, I had to get you on for a spectacular final episode. So there. But hey, I'm chatting about you like everyone knows you. There might be at least one person who doesn't. So yeah, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Okay, I'm Nick Button-Brown. I've been in the gaming industry for coming up to 30 years now. I distinctly remember the first press release that called me a veteran. I was like, that was a sad, sad day. And I started arguing with the PR person, and they were like, you're literally the oldest person in the company. I spent 9 years at EA. I went to Crytek we were working on kind of Crysis. Spent 5 years in Germany, came back to the UK with Improbable, which is... big Silicon Valley tech unicorn, raised a bunch of money to deliver distributed computing, big games and big processing. After that, I then started working with startups. I worked with a few partners that I wanted to. I helped build Outright Games, which we sold to private equity. I helped build Sensible Object, which we sold to Niantic. And then during lockdown, in part because the people that have been really helpful to me over the years had been angels, you know, people that had invested, but they'd been there and done that, I set up an angel group. So we are the Games Angels. We have invested in 32 different companies over 4 years. But the main thing is actually being able to help those companies. So everybody within the group is an industry veteran, and should be able to bring something to a conversation. And it's not telling people how to do it. It's really telling people how not to do it. You know, we've all made the mistakes. Just don't make those mistakes. Make fresh mistakes. That's okay. And then other things, I sit on the board at Yuki. I'm doing a bunch of work at the moment trying to improve financing to UK games companies. Because I think it's important.
And last year, the UK government announced that a new fund, I believe. I think it was around April last year. And you came involved with that. It was great. There's so much to unpack in there, but you managed to get, like I said, almost 30 years into 3 minutes. So that was pretty incredible. But
I mean, there is a hell of a lot of learning in that. I mean, there are many things that I got wrong, and I do look back. I mean, my time at EA, it was such an... Am I allowed to swear?
Yeah.
That's okay, fine. I'm such an arrogant twat. and I was, and I didn't realize that I was, but I'm embarrassed about how I behaved in my mid-20s. I wasn't that bad. I always went into meetings with this idea that I was the smartest person in the room, and I wanted to prove that. And, you know, that's not a great way to approach working with people. So I hope I've learned some of the mistakes, but I'm still learning lots. And the kind of the interesting thing of working with lots of startups is you get to learn really quickly. You get to iterate really fast. You know, you're working with multiple startups. You know, you talk to them, you find out what they're doing. What about this? And they end up doing something different. And you get to learn so quickly. And that's quite exciting. So it's kind of fun. It's a lot of energy. And, you know, when I'm working with a startup, they're kind of excited and they believe they can change the world. And I'm the jaded cynic sitting in the back going, nothing is going to work. And, you know, we average out at something which is a good balance.
I love that. And actually, it's that combination of succeeding in very large, well-known companies to now imparting all of that advice into startups and everything else. And that, I think, gives you quite a unique perspective on these talent topics as well. Also, just, yeah, this is why I love working in a VC right now. I get... Just through osmosis, I get so much energy from working with founders and helping them and watching them succeed. I love it. So
I mean, it's awesome talking to people that don't know what they can't do. I just kind of going into that. Yeah, of course we can do that. I'm like, okay. And sometimes it works out. It doesn't always work out, but it works out often enough that it's quite rewarding.
Yeah, that's awesome. Talking of video games, funnily enough, what are you playing right now?
I started playing Split Fiction last night. I love It Takes Two. It's one of my favorite games of all time. And I'm playing it with my son, so we're sitting down and playing it together. You know, it's kind of good daddy son time, sitting on a couch, proper couch co-op, talking about what's happening. The last one we did was Baldur's Gate 3, which we put about 120 hours into. Oof. And I mean that's good daddy son time, so that makes me happy.
That is great. Yeah, I'm funny enough playing both of those games, because Split Fiction I started on Friday. The great thing about still having friends at EA is that they get you codes. So shout out to Lewis and the EA partners team for that. So I'm playing that with Jake on my team at work that handles.
I've just written down Lewis's name because everybody me codes anymore. Need to get to know Lewis. All right.
can save you £50 every now and then. And so yeah, I'm actually playing that with someone at work, loving it. But we're about 3 hours in. Already a masterclass already in co-op, and It Takes Two. I completed that with my wife, and also A Way Out with my wife previously. So a big fan of the studio. And then Baldur's Gate 3, actually one of our investments called Mod.io is the official modding partner for Baldur's Gate 3. So I'm back in Baldur's Gate 3 again, just turning on all the cheats and everything else and just playing around with that. Because I've never actually played a modded game on console before.
It's interesting. Seeing how different it is.
Yeah, because, you know, there's UGC content, just different, like, you know, playing custom modes in Roblox and Fortnite, etc. That's different to being like, hey, here's this AAA game, and now you can actually mod stuff. And that's why I say it's the first modding experience on console that I've had.
If you play Baldur's Gate 3, I'm going to do my kind of I'm not worthy moment, which was at the BAFTAs last year, I got to meet the actor that played Karlach.
Oh, yes. She was awesome, and
she was so generous with her time, because I was just like, I love you so much, and I have a picture to show to my son, just to rub his face in it that he's not here, you know.
Yeah, I'm a dungeon master for three different groups, and so I love watching all the voice actors have just been getting involved with D&D and streaming and everything. It's like, it's such a unique thing to see, like a group of voice actors then just coming completely enveloped in that world. It's like, when does that happen?
It feels like they've enjoyed it. That's the thing.
Yeah. Yeah. They're reveling in it. That's awesome. Hey, we should probably talk about some talent stuff now. So actually, going back to the beginning of your career, like, how did you get into games? What was that whole story like? And then we can get into the talent stuff.
Yeah. So actually, I played games as a kid. I played games on the Spectrum. I saw Rubber Keyed Wonder, which is a kind of interesting film about the Spectrum. But my problem is that the games that they showed were not the games that I played. I played these amazing worlds, which were beautiful and detailed. And then they showed the games. I mean, I know they're the same games, but they clearly switched the code around. Those were not the games I played. I was kind of carried on playing games and was playing games socially, but I went to uni. When I left, I ended up becoming an accountant. Wasn't a very good accountant, I will admit. And then at the end of that, I decided I wanted to work in something I was more interested in. So I ended up going back into games, but as an accountant. Then over the next, 8 years, I got less and less accountant-y. And kind of moved away from that. I moved to EA. I started working with partners. I started working with Crytek as their partner when I was at EA Partners. And then I ended up moving across and joining Crytek because I thought that would be more fun.
Ah, okay. So, yeah, funny enough, John Wright, who was on this podcast a few weeks back, he also started out as an accountant. That's before. Okay.
It's a great business education. But yeah, it's a bit dull.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so you got into that. Yeah. So Eidos as accountant, then into EA. And then from there, like, learn the ropes of games. So yeah, I can see actually, I've got your LinkedIn profile in front of me. So went into business development and then learned the business of games from there. So that's a pretty fascinating path. I think everybody has their own story.
Yeah. I got into the games industry and then I carried on changing what I was doing, and ultimately at Crytek, I ended up running all the studios. I'm sure you know about this idea about matrix careers. So actually, yeah, you're not progressing, you're building technical, social, soft skills. And I think that's what I've done, but I didn't think about it. A friend of mine started writing a book about it. I was like, oh, you've got a classical matrix career. I'm like, great. So that's just giving me an excuse for all the bad decisions I made. That I'm like, yeah, great, I'll take it.
Yeah. The Americans would say like a jungle, was it a jungle gym? It's not a career ladder, it's a, climbing frame.
Sometimes you move sideways. And I did that a few times, but to do things that I found more interesting.
Yeah. I preach that all the time. Like, if you just follow what you would enjoy and where the learning is, like, everything will click into place. So, yeah.
It's funny. I very rarely tell people I used to be an accountant because it does change their perception.
oh, sorry. I didn't realize you were actually really boring. Is that?
It's always that kind of, are you a game creator? I mean, I'm a terrible designer, but I think I'm fairly good at building teams. I'm an awful designer. I'm a terrible artist. There is nothing within the game that I can do better than the people that are doing it. But that actually frees you up a bit if you know you're not better than them at it, so you don't try.
Yeah. Yeah. And the cool thing about I've been in recruiting for about 12 years, you see so many different career paths. Like, my first thought is like, oh, accounting makes sense. It's numbers and understanding business. And EA always needs plenty. Every business needs that. And so it's like, great, like, sideways move into that. And you just switch into something you're passionate about. Common bit of, the amount of times I could speak to someone who's an accountant, they're like, oh, I want to get into games. So I need to learn how to make games. I was like, you don't, all of these other games companies need accountants, right? Like, start with that. Like, start with a sideways move into that first, rather than trying to learn Unreal or Unity or something. I mean, yeah, if they want to do that, cool, but they forget that they can just take their skills into these business
Yeah, and I mean, I think that the games industry hasn't always been the best at taking skills from outside of the games industry. You know, often it's actually let's other industries do things quite well. Can we pick up some knowledge from that? Can we bring it in? That's not putting them on a pedestal and, oh my God, they know how to do this. But, you know, they've learned over many years. Maybe some of that knowledge is valuable.
Yeah, and I'm also a big advocate for that. If you have a really solid interview process and you really understand the business and values and everything else, then you have the ability to spot that talent from outside the walled garden, which is games, and then you can start bringing in more diverse opinions and these sorts of things. So yeah, I'm totally with you on that. And so, hey, fast forwarding from the beginning of your career to now, so you mentioned you're an angel investor, and you work with, you said you invested in 30 plus companies so far. I would love to know, in your opinion, like what makes a team or a company like investable? Like, what are the things that you're really looking for?
Yeah, I mean, so I'm an angel investor rather than a VC or an investment fund. So my criteria are slightly different. For me, it's two things. It's a good team, and it's a sound business opportunity. The good team is important because you've got to have a chance of delivering it. But also, as a startup, stuff is going to go wrong. And what you want is a team that can deal with the things going wrong. I will admit that that's the main bit of due diligence I do on the companies that I'm looking at, is find out what happened in the past when things went wrong. I like people with battle scars. I like people that have got it wrong before, because it's only then that you start thinking about how you dealt with that. You start looking back and wondering about those mistakes, and you learn so much from the moments when you got it wrong. I'm also slightly cynical. If anybody ever tells me they haven't got things wrong, they're just lying at that stage.
Yeah, I'm just perfect. I'm just too perfect. It's a weakness. Yeah,
my main flaw is my perfection. No, that is a terrible answer.
I'm just thinking, if anyone's listening and they don't understand anything about the world of investment, what does angel investing mean?
Okay. So angels are smaller checks. They tend to be, they're individuals. So they're people coming in. It's like Dragon's Den, but nothing like Dragon's Den. You know, it's people going, I have a little bit of cash. There are great tax incentives that make it worthwhile doing. But you go in, you know, a few of you get together, put a check into a company, and then that will allow them to kind of start and grow. So angels are often the first stage money in. Then after that, you'll get a later round. It's often called a kind of seed round, which involves venture capitalists. So venture capitalists are professional funds like yourself, who are then investing in these businesses and trying to take them to the next stage.
Yep. And usually investing other people's money.
Yes. Sorry, you're right. They will have gone out to a bunch of people around the world and saying, give me 100 million. And 100 million will have arrived and they'll start spending the 100 million.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. We're custodians of a very large pot of money. Yeah. So also you mentioned earlier that, so you invest and then you're an advisor to these companies and you help them and use your experience.
Not always, but there are some that I stay fairly heavily involved with. I mean, I couldn't possibly spend time with 32 companies. That would be nuts.
Valid. Yeah.
There are some that I stay more heavily involved with.
Yeah. So you said earlier as well that it's not necessarily telling them what to do and putting those, like trying to railroad them. It's trying to advise them to avoid the mistakes you made in the past. So what are those mistakes? What do you tend to, there's obviously a lot of learnings along the way, but what are the flags that you typically see most often or things that you're really trying to help founders avoid?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, the list of mistakes is long and tiresome. What are the things, what makes a company, what gives a company a greater chance of success, maybe? I mean, the thing for me, and this also comes from my EA days, is always this balance between creativity and delivery. The best companies that I've worked with have got that balance perfectly. So there is a part of the company that's pushing to make the most amazing thing that could be made. The most creative thing, the pushing the boundaries, delivering a great fun experience. And then on the other side, there's a part of the team that's kind of going, yeah, but we've got to have it out. It's going to be out by this date. It's going to be out with people playing. We've got to deliver it with the money that we've got left, because if we go bust, your grand vision is not going to happen. And so the best companies and the best teams always have that balance between the creativity and the delivery. There are times when it will shift a little bit. So when I was at EA Partners, you know, you definitely look for the start of the game. You wanted more creativity and less delivery. And then as you're passing alpha and getting to the end, it's all about the delivery. We've got to get it out the door. Stop suggesting new ideas. So it can morph over time, but you have to have the potential that you've got both balanced enough so that one side does not defeat the other side consistently.
Great. And I often think about these circles merging in, and also just the teams that I've been a part of throughout my career. I've definitely been in teams that are like all in on one circle and not the other, and then vice versa. So I think sometimes in games, there's, you know, for the art, passion for the art form. It's like, no. Like you need to make this a commercial success as well as a critical one, just so that you can make more games.
Right, just pay you yourself. Don't have to. So you can actually decide that I want to have a lifestyle. I just want to make these really cool things forever. And that's great. You can do that. That doesn't make you investable. You know, being investable is you have to be looking for the commercial success as well.
Yeah, fair, good point. Because
are not right to be invested in, because they just want to do the things that they want to do, and that's great, and they should carry on doing that. And I will carry on playing their games because their games are awesome.
Yeah, and that's actually the number one rejection feedback when I say to people, "Oh, Play Ventures won't be interested in this," and it's because like VCs want the next billion-dollar company. They want to be at the very beginning of the Supercell journey and the Zynga journey and, you know, all of these other giants now and things like that. That's the goal, to find those diamonds in the rough and be there right at the beginning.
But isn't for everyone. Some people don't want to grow in that way. They just want to carry on having, you know, a few friends making a cool thing. Great.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Fantastic. So your investments, I mean, what are they? Do they lean into your gaming experience from platforms and genres of things, or are you pretty open-minded?
I'm pretty open-minded. And in fact, I try to spread out what I'm investing in, particularly what I'm spending time in. You know, I don't just want to do the things that I've done before. I'm interested in newer sectors of the market. I'm interested in things that I think need to be done. I invest in a company called BrainSpark, which is using games to teach educational syllabuses, in particular to neurodiverse kids. So kids that don't do well with an existing school system, you know, are games the way to get them engaged with the content? You know, all of a sudden you're playing a Shakespeare game, but you're talking to the characters. And I met Riddarch. She's just a fantastic leader and really charismatic, and I just wanted that to happen. She managed to come up with a compelling business case as well, but at the start I was like, well, that just has to happen. What else? I've invested in 10-6, who are using AI, and I know AI is a scary subject, but they're using AI to make hyper-personalized games.
Brilliant.
So, you know, based on your interest, based on the things that you're doing, then the game is crafted to be an experience just for you. So the game that you will play will never be played by anyone else. I kind of like that idea. You know, that's using AI for something that couldn't be done before. Not using AI to save money, not using AI to rip off other people's work, but a new experience that couldn't have been done before. I kind of like that.
Yeah, I love it. By the way, my wife's a high school maths teacher at an autism specialist school. So that first one, definitely, I definitely buy into that. And also, secondly, in terms of using AI in games, the reality is, so we've got an AI dev tool investment called Scenario, right? And the reality is that the majority of game studios now are testing and seeing how it can be used. And I tend to think of it as like when procedural tools arrived in game engines, that just sped up development. No one was like, Yeah. As long as it's not scraping the internet, stealing people's stuff, doing all of these unethical practices, then it's like, great. It's an exciting time. Like a small teams can do so much more than before with all of the engine tech, AI tech that's here and coming. And also Asia, game studios in Asia are already shipping stuff with plenty of AI tools being used. So I also look at that and think, okay, well, if these taboos didn't exist, and a lot of time unnecessary taboos, like what could we actually be achieving? And that's yeah. So I don't know if you agree, but that's where my head goes.
I do agree. I mean, I am also cognizant of, you know, the there is a lot of creative work that's gone into it, and actually, how do we fairly reflect the value of that work that's gone in? And I think there are companies that are doing it in an interesting way. I'm not shouting out about my kind of favorite children thing, but you know, Magic A came up with a really interesting licensing system with the actor that they'd used, which actually allowed that person to retain their rights, and it was an ongoing licensing system. So using that, and it's like that's a sound and fair way of doing it. So there are sound and fair ways of doing it.
That's fascinating. Yeah, awesome. And yeah, sorry, I didn't want you to pick and choose and be like, tell me your top three. But yeah,
eclectic taste because I want to be involved in different areas of the business. You know, I work with the Dinmo, who are ad tech and looking at hybrid monetization models. One of my best friends now runs Formation, who are creating a social football game for football fans. You know, and that's, you know, that's a completely different experience to a hardcore console.
And that's why I asked you, actually, because just to show like how wide ranging and also the games industry is. Like you ask the average person about games, they think Call of Duty and FIFA and stuff like that. And it's like, oh, actually, no, this industry is huge and tackling a lot of really interesting problems in many different ways.
And a big part of what we need to do. So one of the other things I'm working on, and you feel free to cut this out later. I'm working on an econometrics report. So this is valuing the social, commercial, and cultural impact of gaming, because it's not about Call of Duty. Call of Duty is part of the market, but it is about Bury Me My Love. And it is about actually is games, the friends that you make when playing online are so much stronger than friends that you make within social media. So actually is games one of the cures for the scourge of loneliness? You know, how do we see the value that's created through education, through using consoles at an abuse shelter? So, you know, there are women that often, unfortunately, they are predominantly women who go in, they move in, and they can't take all their kids in, so they only take one kid into the abuse shelter. So their other kids are staying with another relative, and that kind of breaks that family dynamic, and they don't have anything to talk about. You put them in front of a console and the kids just play together because they're kids and it doesn't matter. And they're just playing because they're kids. And then maybe conversations happen. But for that period of time, they feel like normal kids. Yeah, that's incredibly valuable. We should talk about that far more.
Yeah. And bring that narrative into the wider media rather than all of the inevitably false and negative views that get put out into the press sometimes. So that's great.
I mean, we do have a new GTA coming. We know that that's going to dominate the narrative a while. But at the same time, maybe we should, if you haven't seen it, watch a documentary called Remarkable Life of Ibelin. It's fantastic.
Oh, is this the World of Warcraft one on Netflix?
Kid that died, his parents, really sad, thought he'd never had a life. And then after his death, just this world of friends that he was involved in came out. And, you know, how tremendous for his parents to have seen the life that he'd had.
Yeah, brilliant. That's been on my watch list for far too long. I've got flights to GDC coming up. That will be on my... I'll download it ahead of time. I've got 20 hours of flights coming up, so...
not a brilliant one for a flight because I did cry. You know, I'm not... Yeah. I mean, I was loving.
I guarantee I will cry. This is just me these days watching films. So, that's brilliant. Thanks so much for that. Definitely won't cut that out. I think this is all really, really valuable work. Hey, we're not quite closing up to the end, but we still do have a few minutes left. I would love to go back to your learnings in your career on the talent side. So, for example, you said that you were leading the game teams at Crytek, and you worked your way up at EA, and you've been in leadership positions in game studios and game publishers for a long time. So, I guess the question is, what do you find is the most important thing that you've learned as a leader and a manager of people? And then, can you spot those telltale signs in other people, other teams, as well? Or is it very much this is what I learned as a manager in my own style and experience? That was a very long question. I hope you can.
So I've managed large teams. I struggled with managing large teams. So my kind of personal learning is I like small teams. Everybody's working together. They all love each other. Everybody buys into the decision. The decision-making is so quick and responsive. That's the kind of team I really like. As it gets bigger, as people lose that sense of ownership, as the communication gets worse, and as more people, a smaller number of people are carrying the load for a wider group, that's really difficult to manage. So a lot of my advice is just keep the team small, or at least find a way to structure a series of small teams. So don't build a 150-person team, build 5 20-person teams. And then that allows them to kind of keep that ownership. What are other lessons? Honesty. I mean, there are times when I've had to deliver bad messages to the teams that I've been involved in. It's better to be honest, straight, talk about it, answer questions, don't hide. But that isn't immediate honesty. So, it's not, I've had a bad day, something bad has happened. I don't need to tell the whole team that, because that's my job. My job is to deal with that, and then tomorrow that problem has gone away. So you're communicating the big things, but don't scare the crap out of them with the little things. Because there are just days, there's a problem with the bank, fine, great. We'll deal with it, we'll get through it. But you don't need to scare people with that. What other lessons have I learned? Don't buy a bloody Ferrari.
Great advice.
You'd think that kind of went without saying. Turns out you really do need to say it. Don't buy a Ferrari, and certainly don't park it in the company parking lot. Okay.
It's funny how many times you hear that in with these explosive growth success stories and stuff, and it's often a sign of, the culture's changed somewhat.
Yeah, yes, it's the sign that almost kind of people have given up. The thing that they were making is not so important anymore. But I mean, changing culture is not necessarily bad. I was at EA when EA was an amazing place. I'm not saying it isn't an amazing place now, but we went to Club Med as a company. I think EA is still banned from Club Med. Well, Electronic Arts is not allowed to go to Club Med or Euro Disney because a few people decided that mattress surfing was a good idea. And,
we will not name names. I'm just imagining going to Club Med and there's just a picture of you behind the reception desk.
Not me. I'm always the good one. So EA, people think of EA as this kind of staid, steady business, but there was a time when it was an explosive business. But the people that were there at that time are not the people who would be right for this version of EA. One of my other learnings is recognize that where you are in the time of the development of that company. And sometimes even you as a founder, it's the right thing to do to go. It's the right thing to do to hand over to somebody else. So just have that level of self-awareness that you may have been the right person at that stage, but now the company's bigger. your skills do not fit to that new company.
Yeah. And I've seen that firsthand as well. And culture, every time you add a single person into a team or a business, the culture changes. And yes. So naturally, when you're 20 people compared to 500, or 20 people compared to 100, then it's going to be a wildly different. And like I said, that's fine. That's okay. Like, as long as you're still clear on values and mission and everything else.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm now coming out with lots of other stuff. So you will have to stop me because I'll just...
That's fine. That's exactly why I asked the question.
the one that I have learned over, and I always thought it was a kind of gross generalization at the start, but more and more, I think it's true, is that A people hire double A people and B people hire C people. I thought it was just oversimplifying the problem. I've definitely seen that when you've got good people, they'll try and hire people who are better than them because they want to learn from them. When you've got people who aren't as good, they're trying to protect themselves a little bit more. And it's not a conscious thing, but I do look at where people are hiring. If they're hiring people that are better than them, fantastic. Those are great people. But if you're looking at the people that they're hiring, if they're not very good, then it's worth questioning what's going on there. I feel that one's a slightly controversial one, but maybe not.
No. I fully, fully believe that. Google actually came out with some good data to prove that as well in the book Work Rules from Laszlo Bock. And they, this book probably came out 10 years ago now, so a bit of an old reference. But yeah, there was some proof on that, like looking at, and when you Google on that size, you can look at, okay, hiring manager, their performance review, how are they rated? And then given hiring tasks, then a year on, they've hired a team, how are they rated? Compared to hiring managers that are rated right at the very top, how are their team performing? Oh, they're a team full of high performers. So that was quite interesting. So no, I don't think controversial at all. I think very true. I think A players, like the top talent, will also have an unwavering demand to be surrounded by great people as well, smart people.
Some of my saddest moments come from the point where I've had that amazing talent, and because we've expanded, the people that are coming in are not as good at them. So I'm actually diluting that amazing talent rather than helping them to be better. That's all. When I look back, those are some of my biggest regrets, is where there were some amazing people and I wasn't able to help them get more amazing.
It is, when you talk about symptoms of growing fast, I think it all kind of boils down to that. It's like, have you just thrown people at this business, or have you been really methodical, really purposeful with your growth and very clear on the bar that you're aiming for with your talent? Because it is far too easy to grow exceptionally fast and then just lower that bar to hit the headcount targets on time. Awesome. Any other thoughts? Before my last question comes in, any other?
One interesting one that I was talking to. So it's kind of partially about how you're selling your company. So you need to have somebody that can kind of talk about your company. I ended up getting into a conversation about extrovert versus introvert. So most people think I'm an extrovert. My wife, who's an occupational psychologist, says I'm an introvert who has learned extroversion. So I cover up for it. But one of the interesting pieces of research I was reading was that there are different It's not a two-dimensional line. Actually, there are different kinds of introversion. It's more of a kind of three-dimensional space where you are. So anybody that is thinking about how they're wants to know more about themselves, advised to read the report on the different kinds of introversion.
That's pretty fascinating. I love talking about this. In fact, when I joined Play Ventures last year, I got everyone to do the Myers-Briggs.
with the extra bits added on, so the Myers-Briggs plus the other stuff.
Yeah, I say Myers-Briggs, the 16 personalities website, which does a very good job, I think, of condensing it. But what I just wanted, I don't people have pushed back on the Myers-Briggs and everything else. And I'm like, that's fine. What it is a framework to allow us to like open up and talk about our strengths and also where we are challenging our weaknesses, let's say. So if you're like, okay, my type is ENTP. By the way, extroversion for me is like, you know, they do put it on a linear scale. And I'm usually around the 95% extrovert. So
I understand that.
Yeah. All jazz hands all the time, apparently.
Everything is better with jazz hands, let's be
honest. Yeah. But point being, I do love talking
about
the team dynamics.
Somebody that runs their own podcast would be an extrovert. Yes. Just...
Yeah. It's almost like he loves his own voice. That's crazy. Yeah. Yeah. By the way, the fascinating thing, they're more perfectly lined up with that exercise. So 14 of us did it. I plotted all of the results on screen. So, you know, there's four different lettering. I won't go too deep into this. But anyway, there's four different things you can be. So extrovert or introvert, and then intuitive or sensing, and et cetera. Anyway, I plotted everyone on the thing. And the majority were in E, then N, then T, then P, which, funny enough, is mine. But also, Hari and Henrik, the founders of our company, are also ENTP. And I was like, here's a good example of how the founders of a company can shape culture. If you plot us all in general, and I didn't tell everyone this is what I was trying to do. I just proved the point about culture, which I was like, oh, that worked out very, very nicely in the end. So I thought that was quite interesting.
I mean, so Myers-Briggs as a standalone is not that useful, but as a tool to get people discussing it, I think it's really helpful. And then you start looking at the people that are kind of struggling within that culture. Often they've got an aspect that is different to everyone else, and that doesn't always feel like they fit in. So we have to be understanding of that, but also valuing of that. You know, the kind of the intuition versus the sensing, the thinking versus the feeling. You do need a bit of both.
Mm, definitely. Yeah, and just being able to plot on a screen and be like, hey, you're the outlier. I remember at EA, we did this, and I was like the outlier every time. I was like, oh, look, there's Joe all the way off there. And they're older. I'm like,
But you're the kind of person that will like being the outlier. There are other people that will hate being the outlier. You're like, yay, I'm the outlier, bring it on.
Yeah, I'm a misfit. Great. I love it.
Your favorite Star Wars character is Han Solo, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. You know, actually, we did another psychometric thing at Epic, and like the 100 people in the people of the team at the time did it. And there were, and my, they're like 20 different subcategories, and mine was Maverick. And I was like, yeah, I'll take that. Top Gun stuff. I'll take it.
I win. I won the psychology test.
Yeah, if I've got the best one, right? This is how it works.
I have the best one. That's fantastic. I have the best personality type.
Oh, there we go. There we go. You're peering into my brain now. So there you go.
I feel I have a window into your soul.
Amazing. Hey, we do actually have to wrap this up. I'm afraid I would actually love to keep laughing and to chat to you all day. My final question I ask for everybody who comes on here is, what is your favorite interview question?
I used to have kind of gimmicky questions. They fallen very out of fashion. Well, I used to love the what's your favorite superpower, because people came up with some really weird answers. But my actual useful question is, you know, we've talked about something that they've done in their previous career, you know, a place that they were working, something interesting. And I normally want to, I normally ask them, so what would your boss at the time say about you? If I went and asked them today, what would they say about you? And I quite like that, because you tend to get quite a lot of honesty, in part because there's a chance that I will go and ask them. So there is that potential that this is a kind of fact checking, but you do get people being fairly self-reflecting in that. And I find the set of answers you get from that quite interesting.
I like that as well. I really like that question, actually, because there's a few things there. There's, is this person empathetic? Like, can they give a viewpoint from another person and self-reflect, but also reflect from there? And yeah, like you said, it's it's a very opening question to get someone to be very critical of themselves. And almost like a barrier, because they can be like, oh yeah, my manager would say this about me, in fairness, because of X, Y, Z. And you can get into a deep discussion there. What would a green flag question, answer to that sound like? And what would a red flag one sound like to that?
A green flag is just kind of honesty and self-reflection, you know, that somebody has thought about the things. Ideally, it's a thing that they've already been talking about, so a problem that they've overcome, how the person would reflect on that. I don't want perfect people. I want battle scars. I've got a bunch of battle scars. You know, I want somebody that, yeah, has got things wrong, so I don't mind people getting things wrong, but I want them to understand why they got them wrong. So a green flag answer is anything which is kind of proper self-reflection in there, and which isn't the, you know, what's my greatest weakness is, oh, I'm just too detail-oriented, you know, something generic. So yeah, a green flag is something which is thought through and not generic. And what's a red flag? Something which is generic. You know, it's just, but also something that would contradict the other things that they've been saying.
Okay.
So if it doesn't stack up, then inconsistency within an interview is an absolute killer.
Yeah. The mistake of someone's clearly prepared a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And it's just like, I think the answer to this question is this thing I've prepared. So it's disingenuous. And
I'm all about, within the games that I play, within the people that I work with, the thing that matters the most to me is authenticity. And so anything that doesn't feel authentic will, you know, it will set my spidey sense tingling.
Yeah. But the battle scars comment, I recall, Mike Sievers, who I worked with for a little bit of time at Epic, he was a former CTO at Riot, and he'd be like, Joe, like, do not hire fair weather managers. Like, he would be talking about fair weather, insert job title here, and using that title. He's like, no, you want to find someone who's just been through the trenches and still's coming out on top and succeeding and everything else. And more importantly, learn from it. I think it's the main thing there. So. Yeah.
I mean, I've got many things wrong, but I've learned so much from them. And, you know, you can look at my LinkedIn profile and work out which bits I think were the most wrong. But I still learn the most from them. Because you learn much quicker when it's going wrong.
Yeah. And you learn more about yourself. Like, what happens to me when I'm under pressure? Like, if you've never been under pressure, you have no idea. So, yeah.
In Germany, I was diagnosed with a skin condition, which... translated from the German was, you have a thick skin.
I laughed, but you just told me you were diagnosed. I'm like, oh my goodness, is it?
It's
severe?
You have a thick skin. I'm like, what? And it's like, yeah, you have a thick skin. So that's it. I am officially diagnosed as having a thick skin.
Oh, wow. Yeah, gotta love the Germans for that. For that diagnosis. That's amazing. That, you should put that on your LinkedIn profile.
I wanted a certificate, you know?
Yeah. Officially thick-skinned. And on that note, I have to say thanks so much for coming on the podcast and sharing that all of that learning. I feel like we've got coming up to 50 minutes of tons of nuggets of goodness and learnings about your, like I said, almost 30 years career from AAA to angel investing and everything in between. So, yeah, massive thank you. Appreciate it.
No, thanks for bringing me on, Joe. And I look forward to hearing it, although I probably won't listen to myself because that's not a thing I can do.
You know, I would say the majority of guests say the same thing. So, yeah.
You're but, yeah. The outlier, Joe. You're the maverick.
I listen to them all over and over and over again.
I listen to them at night when I'm with a lady.
Yeah. Helps me get to sleep. Amazing. Well, thank you. And I hope you see you in person soon.
All right. Good to talk to you. Thanks, Joe.